Around the clock, around the world, Bloomberg keeps you connected on television, online, on the radio, and on mobile.
This month in Bloomberg Markets Magazine, China's billionaire builder, the story of Zhang Jin, the former sweatshop worker who became one of China's richest women by investing in real estate in Beijing and Shanghai. I'm Ron Hinkoff, editor of Bloomberg Markets, with a look at our September issue on sale on newsstands now. Also in this issue, duping the families of foreign soldiers, our exclusive special report on how life insurance companies are holding on to death benefits owed to relatives of service members and millions of other Americans. You'll also find stories on Bank of England Governor Mervyn King, hedge fund manager Dan Oak, India's Maoist rebellion, and Brazil's obsession with drilling for oil in deep water. Now to our cover story, China's billionaire builder, the story of Zhang Jin. With me on the line from his base in Sydney, Australia, is senior writer William Meller, author of the Zhang Jin story. Now, Bill, just after your story was published, China officially surpassed Japan to become the world's second largest economy, capping three decades of remarkable growth. In the process, something unthinkable has happened. This still nominally communist country has created a whole class of billionaires, many of which you've written about. And one of the most extraordinary stories is the one you tell in this issue of Bloomberg Markets, the story of Zhang Jin. Tell us a little bit about this 45-year-old woman. What's her background? How did she start out? And how did she become a billionaire? Tell us about her and her company, Soho China, which I understand has nothing to do with either the Soho in London or the Soho in New York, which she founded with her husband, Pan Shi. Tell us about Zhang Jin, Bill.
Zhang Jin truly personifies the story of modern China. As you mentioned, she's only 45, relatively young for a billionaire anywhere in the world, yet she's lived through and been at the front line of her country's astonishing transformation from the poverty and hopelessness of Mao Zedong's doctrinaire communist rule to the real dynamism of what's now the world's fastest growing economy and, as you say, has just overtaken Japan in size. Zhang was born in 1965, when Mao was about to embark on the insanity of the Cultural Revolution, when the intelligentsia, like members of Zhang's family, were sent to work as peasants in the countryside. Her parents were government translators in Beijing. They separated during the Cultural Revolution, and Zhang and her mother ended up living in a rural commune. From there, like so many other refugees, they made their way absolutely penniless to Hong Kong, which was then a British colony. For 5 years, from the age of 14, Zhang worked in factory sweatshops, sewing garments and assembling cheap electrical products. She lived in, and her mother lived in bunk beds in a tiny rented room, sharing a bathroom with other families. And somehow this teenager managed to save enough money for an air ticket to England and have enough left over to put herself through secretarial school, where she learnt English and also learned how to apply for educational scholarships. She earned an undergraduate degree from Sussex University, and then she got a master's from Cambridge. And on the strength of that, she landed a job on Wall Street. She worked for Goldman Sachs and Travelers Group for about 3 years before, homesick, she returned to China. And that's where her story gets even more interesting. This very westernized, fluently English-speaking investment banking analyst had an introduction to a young Beijing entrepreneur named Pan Shiyi, who was a partner in a property company. Pan was also self-made, but apart from that, the two of them couldn't be more different. He couldn't speak a word of English, and he knew nothing about life outside China, but he was incredibly smart. And within 4 days of meeting her, Pan proposed marriage. She accepted, and soon after that, Pan quit the company he worked for, and he and Zhang set up their own company called Soho China, and their timing was absolutely exquisite. This was the mid-1990s. Mao had been dead for almost 20 years, and a new leader, Deng Xiaoping, had declared that to get rich is glorious. Beijing was attempting to transform itself from a city of bicycles and Stalinist architecture to a worthy capital for an emerging superpower. And it was building a whole new central business district on the site of derelict factories. Zhang and Pan hit on the idea of hiring smart young architects to design avant-garde buildings tailor-made for a new breed of emerging entrepreneurs. You're right, the company name Soho China has nothing to do with Manhattan or London. It stands for Small Office Home Office, and that's what their first buildings were. They were places where smart young Chinese could both live and work. And today those buildings account for about 20% of the office space in Beijing's central business district. And Soho China is far and away the biggest developer in China's capital city.
They sort of lease to people like themselves, right? Young entrepreneurial type people who represent this new generation, this relatively young generation.
They did back then, certainly, and they built special apartments. Some of them had had walls that were removable, so people could take an area of space and they could live in it. They could use it as their office or do anything they liked. And the difference as well is that they didn't sell whole buildings or lease out whole buildings. They sold them off in small units, so people could buy them relatively cheaply, and also Zhang didn't have to borrow too much money to finance these buildings.
Well, if you spent any time in China, as I know you have, and I have a few times over the years, it's just striking the amount of building that's going on in that country. And many people in China and certainly outside of China are very concerned that there's too much building. And certainly those of us in the West have learned to our peril over the past few years what can happen when any country overinvests in real estate. And it would affect not just developers like Zhang Ji and her husband, but the entire Chinese economy, upon which so much of the world is depending for growth. And it would seem, from reading your story, that the Chinese government itself agrees, at least in part, with some of this analysis and is taking some steps to actually cool things down. What is the Chinese government doing?
You're right. Many Chinese officials have expressed concerns about an emerging bubble. They're in a real dilemma, though. When the global financial crisis struck, China's export-driven economy looked in serious trouble. So China came up with a massive $585 billion stimulus package. And on top of that, they encouraged banks to go on a $1.4 trillion lending binge. Much of that money went into real estate, even though a lot of that real estate remains unoccupied today. There are these so-called see-through buildings that you see all over China. And companies that weren't even supposed to be in the property business started trying to outbid each other for property. In the first quarter of this year, mainland China overtook Hong Kong to become the world's hottest real estate market, rising 68%, according to the London property consultants Knight Frank. That's when Beijing's rulers really decided enough was enough. They clamped down on bank lending. Firstly, they hiked the bank reserve requirements. Then they also ordered state-owned companies whose core business isn't property to withdraw from the market. Then in April, regulators ordered banks not to lend money to speculators. The cabinet also raised the down payment ratios on second home purchases. And in Beijing, the city government even banned families from buying more than one home.
And are these steps having an effect, and what kind of an effect are they having?
Yeah, they had the effect of not only, to some extent, hosing down the property market, but also the entire economy. And for instance, in the first quarter of 2010, gross domestic product growth was 11.9%, which is high, really high, even by Chinese standards. In the second quarter, that had been trimmed back to 10.3%.
That's interesting. Now, it would seem like some of these steps are bad news for developers like Zhang Ji, and yet she remains relentlessly bullish, not just on her own business and her own sector, but on the whole Chinese economies. I mean, how do you explain that, or how does she explain that?
Yes, she's optimistic because she believes the Chinese government has just acted in time. As recently as the beginning of this year, she also feared a bubble, and she'd even stopped going to land auctions because she was fed up with big state-owned companies paying what she thought were ridiculous prices for land. But she's optimistic now because rather than just relying on government figures, which in China can be a bit questionable, she's witnessed with her own eyes a cooling of demand. Prices haven't plunged, but sales volumes have come down, and that gives her confidence that the government is managing to engineer a soft landing rather than a crash.
Well, soft landing, that's a term we've heard certainly in the United States, and there didn't seem to be the softest of landings here. And there are many people inside China and particularly outside China who are worried that it's going to be a hard landing. Tell us what the people you spoke to said about their concerns about if there is a hard landing in China, particularly for real estate. What are the implications for China and Asia and beyond?
Well, it certainly would be bad news. As I mentioned, property investment and related industries account for about 20% of China's gross domestic product. And in turn, the OECD estimates that China will account for one-third of global growth this year. If China's economy crashes, the world could be in for a double-dip recession, according to people I spoke to, people such as Jim Walker, who's a veteran Asia hand based in Hong Kong. And particularly badly affected could be the countries that supply the commodities that fuel China's growth, such as the big iron ore exporting nations like Brazil and Australia. But the question is the property bubble about to burst? And some of the greatest names in finance and sinology have totally opposing views on where China's going. People like Stephen Roach, the chairman of Morgan Stanley Asia, he believes China can achieve a soft landing, but other people like Andy Hsieh, formerly of Morgan Stanley and now an independent economist in Shanghai, reckon it's a very serious bubble that eventually will burst with disastrous consequences.
Well, I don't think we can figure that out now, but in the meantime, Zhang Jin remains defiant and has some pretty extensive projects in the work, both in Beijing and in Shanghai. And I use the term futuristic in your story, and you mentioned how they've always kind of gone for these avant-garde architects. What can you tell us about the plans that they have in the works in China's two big cities?
She's just completed one called Sanlitun Soho, which is it's right in the diplomatic area of Beijing. So it's an almost perfect location. There's a famous entertainment street called the Sanlitun Bar Street just around the corner. It's just right in the heart of the central business district. And that's sort of shaped like, it's almost kind of a waveform. It's very avant-garde architecture. And the next one, she's already started selling. It's called Galaxy, and it's right beside the Second Ring Road, which used to be the Beijing city walls until Mao tore the city walls down. But that's designed by Zaha Hadid, the Baghdad-born, London-based Pritzker Prize-winning architect, and it combines commercial, retail, and entertainment space, and it's in a series of sort of linked white oval-shaped buildings that sort of resemble cocoons. It's going to be another extraordinary addition to a Beijing skyline that already is quite extraordinary. And then in Shanghai, she's acquired one building from Morgan Stanley, and now she's just snapped up the last piece of vacant land on the place that's the strip that's called the Bund, the colonial era waterfront strip beside the Huangpu River. So in terms of betting there's not going to be a bubble, she's certainly putting her money where her mouth is.
Yeah, that's certainly clear. Well, thanks very much, Bill. I'm Ron Hentkopf, editor of Bloomberg Markets Magazine. I've been speaking with William Meller, author of the cover story in our September issue, China's Billionaire Builder. The story of the extraordinary rise of real estate developer Zhang Jin. The September issue also features our investigative report on how life insurers are duping the families of fallen soldiers. You can find my special podcast on the fallen soldiers story, along with podcasts from previous month's issues, on iTunes or on Bloomberg.com. In the September issue, you'll also find stories on Bank of England Governor Mervyn King, hedge fund manager Dan Oak, India's Maoist rebellion, and Brazil's infatuation with drilling for oil in deep water. All this and more is in the September 2010 issue of Bloomberg Markets Magazine, available now on newsstands and at Borders and Barnes & Noble bookstores throughout the U.S., as well as at selected outlets in major cities in Europe and Asia. To subscribe to Bloomberg Markets, visit our website at BloombergMarkets.com. I'm Ron Henkoff, editor of Bloomberg Markets. Thanks for listening.
Copyright Bloomberg LP 2010.